a time, there was a radio show called the Eric Metaxas Show.
It had an announcer named Todd, who was the handsomest announcer in the land. Eric was bitterly jealous of Todd's good looks.
But there was nothing he could do.
He just had to accept that cruel fate had made him as ugly as a toad.
And now your host, warts and all, Eric Metaxas.
I'm really hurt by that one, Todd. Just want you to know, yes, I have feelings. And I hate you. I hate you so much. All right, I got to put on the game face, folks. This is the Eric Metaxas Show, and I get this hour to interview someone that I've interviewed before, and I liked it so much, I said, let's do it again. His name is Jonathan Burness, and he has written a new book called Seven Keys to Understanding Israel's Role in the End Times, Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. Jonathan Burness, welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Eric, it's great to be back with you. That was the most interesting open I've ever heard.
That's a nice way of putting it. You don't know Todd Wilkerson, but man, he's hurtful. He's hateful. He's just mean. And I've had enough of it. I've had enough just between you and me.
I feel it. I feel your
really,
pain.
It really hurts. Okay, so Your new book is called Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. What does that mean?
It means, Eric, just in summary, that Israel, as the very centerpiece, and when I say Israel, I'm talking not just about the land of Israel, that little sliver of land in the Middle East about the size of New Jersey, but the people of Israel. So that includes the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob scattered to the nations, that Israel is really God's timepiece and centerpiece for understanding not only the last days, but God's redemptive plan for the world.
That's now, I should make clear to the audience that you're not just an author, you are the president and CEO of Jewish Voice Ministries International. Jewish Voice Ministries International. And you obviously know of more about Israel than I do because I've never visited Israel. I'm not going to visit Israel until January, and I'm excited about it. But let's talk about what you say in the book, because many people, I think, you know, more people than not do have a sense that God is a God of history. And it's not just, hey, here we are, and who knows, that there's something larger, that there's a plan, and Israel plays a role. So tell us, what do you say in the book when you say you want to unlock the prophetic mysteries?
Well, I need to start from the beginning, and the book kind of builds on this foundation and works in layers. So to understand the end, we have to go back to the beginning. And the starting point at the book is the fall of man and a dramatic shift in everything that God created. God creates a paradise, and he creates man in perfect fellowship with him. The voice of the Lord is walking in the garden. And by the way, just an interesting side note, that doesn't make much sense until you understand that the voice is the Memra. The ancient sages of Israel understood this is the Memra, which is the word of God. And then voice makes no sense, but it's the word of the Lord. It's Yeshua. It's Jesus walking in
wow,
the garden.
Wow, wow, wow. That's the price of the book and the price of the radio show, which people are getting for free.
I threw one in. And
that was a gimme. You just said is huge. In the first pages of the Bible, in the story of Genesis, it says the voice of the Lord was walking in the garden.
Makes no sense, right?
Now, first of all, that's a stinko translation.
Mm-hmm.
Because what does that mean? The voice of the Lord is walking in the garden. And you're telling me that the Hebrew word is memra.
Actually, the Aramaic. It's the Aramaic.
I thought the Bible was written in Hebrew, not in Aramaic. The Genesis is the Pentateuch, right? So how is it in Aramaic?
Well, it was brought out in the Targums. The Targums were an Aramaic translation from the Hebrew. Both languages were were prevalent, and that's where it really, I think, comes out with clarity. The idea.
What is the Hebrew? Since people are scoring at home.
The Hebrew is devar, which also can denote word. It's the word still.
Okay.
But it really comes clear with the idea of the memra, the word of the Lord. There's no other way to translate.
Well, the funny thing is that when you think of the word of the Lord, capital W, I think of capital W, the Greek word logos, because the logos to Theou is more than just the word small w. It means something more. So when all through the Old Testament you hear about, and the word of the Lord came to Moses, and the word of the Lord, what is the word that's used in those cases?
I believe devar also. I haven't looked at every kind of word study on every translation of the use of the Hebrew.
But you're saying that in the first book of Genesis that it means the word of the Lord was walking in the garden, which we would think of as a theophany, this is the presence of Jesus. This is the presence of God walking in the garden.
Exactly. And there's so many theophanies that are often missed by Christians in reading the scriptures. Melchizedek.
Oh, man, Melchizedek. That's where I learned the word theophany. We got to tell people. The word theophany, theos is God in Greek, theos. And phani is like where you get, in Greek we say phanete, I'm forgetting, where do we get it? Well, it's kind of the root where we get phantasm. It's an appearance. And so the appearance of God is a theophany. So tell us about Melchizedek. Are we getting too far off the
No, I think this is important stuff. Melchizedek makes, again, Abraham recognizes him as the priest of the Most High God, pays tithes to him, clearly recognizes him as an authority, and Abraham is the father of the Jewish people. He becomes God's representative.
But just explain to people in the audience who are listening, saying, I have no idea what the heck you're talking about. This is one of the mysteries of the Bible. What
it
people
is.
Have debated, what the heck do they mean about Melchizedek? Who's Melchizedek? He sort of shows up, and it's a little bizarre. And people have said this is a theophany. This is actually God.
Sure, and I'll tell you why. It doesn't make much sense until you go to look at the Hebrew. Melchizedek is two Hebrew words, melech, which is king, and tzadek, or tzadik, which is tzadaka, which is righteousness, tzadak. He is the king of righteousness. Melech tzadek, he's the king of righteousness.
Wow.
This is So then it's a giveaway, once you understand the Hebrew origin. This is the pre-incarnate Messiah, clearly a theophany. And it repeats itself over and over again. Remember the angels that visited Abraham. One of them was not an angel. He was more than an angel. On and on and on.
I love these mysteries in the Bible. I mean, anybody, even somebody who's not serious about God or about the Bible, there are mysteries in here, folks. Really fascinating mysteries. And I don't want to get us hung up, but go ahead. You said you wanted to go to the beginning. So in Genesis, you said that the Word of God is walking in the garden. So you have a sense that Jesus, the pre-incarnate Jesus, is walking in Eden.
Exactly. And the picture that I want to paint here, Eric, is that there is a perfect fellowship between God and man. That's what God created in the beginning. And it was Gan Eden. It was the Garden of Eden. It was a lush paradise. In fact, the Hebrew concept of the world to come is Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, a restoration of the Garden of Eden. So you have this incredible creation that we can't comprehend. The beauty, the fellowship, just the whole experience is something that we can't really understand because we live in a fallen world.
Okay. Well, when we come back, I want to obviously continue the conversation. I'm talking to Jonathan Burness. He's the host of Jewish Voice. That's a radio program. And the book is Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. Stick around. is the Eric Metaxas Show. I know a lot of you have been out there saying, Eric, why don't you play more ELO? Why don't you play more Electric Light Orchestra? And I'm trying to help you out. So I'm talking to Jonathan Burness. The new book is Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. Jonathan Burness, what else do we need to know to set this up?
Okay, so I was describing this scenario of a perfect world, a paradise, a Garden of Eden, and then comes the fall, and everything changes. The world is completely transformed by the fall negatively. Death comes into the world, sin comes into the world, weeds come into the world. What we're experiencing today is the result of the fall of man. But in the midst of this tragic moment in history, where, by the way, there's not only physical death, there's spiritual death, and there's the death of a animal, because God has to now provide a covering for man as a result of sin. So you have this theme, which I talk about in the book, of the life of the flesh is in the blood, a whole sacrificial system that requires death to bring life, to bring covering, kapora. So God covers man, but then he...
But that's a huge point. I've talked about that a lot, because I remember when I first heard this, my mind was blown. The idea that they cover themselves with fig leaves, and God says, that's not good enough. Death, an animal has to die. Innocent life has to die. Blood has to be shed in order for your sin to be covered. It's symbolic. It's powerful. It points to Jesus way in the future, that blood will have to be shed to cover the sins of mankind. And but that, you know, it just says that he made for them skins. And, you know, it doesn't say in the text, oh, and by the way, he killed an animal. But skin, you know, whatever, you've said it. But it's a fascinating teaching point.
And it lays a foundation for all of the other covenants that follow, leading up, of course, to the atonement of Jesus. So you understand it only in the light of this decree of atonement that to cover death, to provide God's covering. Anyway, there's then a judgment in Genesis chapter 3, where God judges the serpent and God judges man and woman. We're still living in that reality now, because he judges the woman and says you'll bear children in pain. And all the women listening know that that's true today. I went through those labor pains with my wife. And
well, you didn't actually go through the pains with her. I think most women are thinking, are you kidding?
Well, that's what she said to me. She said, that's baloney. You have no idea what I experienced, yeah. She said. And I she's right. And then man is judged. You'll work and you'll sweat and it'll never be enough and you'll wander. All of these things that happened as a result of the fall, the banishment from the garden. But the main point is that in the midst of this tragic moment comes the glimmer of light, the proto-evangelion, as scholars call it, Genesis 3:15, that I will put division or enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. Your seed will bruise his heel, but her seed will crush your head. Now, we've all heard that, but I think that needs to be a refocus of our attention, because this is the revelation of God's redemptive plan for mankind. And I believe that everything else that follows in Scripture and in history has been the unfolding of this great saga of redemption.
I just love this, because you're saying stuff that so many people don't know. Some people know this, it's old hat, but the idea that it says right in Genesis, say the phrase again, your heel, go ahead.
Well, you will bruise his heel, the seed of the serpent, but he will crush your head. It's a death sentence decreed by the God of creation.
Right, so the point is that the snake, Satan, the seed of the woman, which is to say her descendant, you will bruise his heel and he will crush your head. And so the idea that that Satan gets his lick in. He gets to attack. He gets to bite. He gets to do something. But when he does that, prophetically, the one he bites will crush his head and destroy him forever and kill him forever. There's so many things in the Old Testament that point to what happens on the cross. I mean, when you start understanding the puzzle, it's fascinating.
Exactly. And that's the beginning. That's the first promise of redemption. And let me throw in a couple of other things here. The seed of the woman is very strange language. And when they interpreted the Hebrew scriptures into Greek around 250 BC, we call this the Septuagint, which means 70. And it was not a Christian translation. It was a Jewish translation. 2 centuries before Jesus ever came, they looked at this verse and they translated the Hebrew word zarah, which is seed, as sperma. This is the sperma, which means descendant, but it's also the seed of the woman. It makes no sense, the sperma of the woman, until you find the prophecy of a virgin birth. A woman.
Holy cow, that's kind of, I've never heard that one before.
It's the virgin birth. And the rabbis grappled with this. The sages of old in Judaism grappled with this. The seed of the woman.
The rabbis did a lot of grappling.
They did a lot of grappling. They're still grappling today.
No, but I mean, in all seriousness, they basically, I love the reverence they have for the text, that when there's something they don't understand, they grapple with it. They walk around it and look at it from every different angle to understand what is the deeper meaning. Because they assume there is a deeper meaning. They don't just say, oh, it's just words. They understand these are the words of God. Wow.
And to read their arguments, it's amazing. There's volume after volume after volume. They've been doing it for centuries. So there's great wisdom. But I believe this is the virgin birth. This is the prophecy of the virgin birth, the seed of the woman, the impregnated woman, and what that impregnation brings to the world is the one who will fulfill a death sentence that God has decreed over Satan. So Satan has been walking around with the divine death sentence since the garden.
Well, yes, that's right. Well, let's keep leaping along. What about the, did we cover the Abrahamic blessing?
Not yet, but I've got to jump in and say one other thing that's really cool. This promise of redemption is something I think that Adam and Eve understood. And in Genesis 4:1, there's a very interesting statement that with the help of the Lord, I've conceived a man. But if you go back to the Hebrew, Eric, it says, with the help of the Lord, or rather, I have conceived a man who is the Lord. Literally in Hebrew, the statement is that I have brought forth a child, the Lord. I believe that Adam and Eve thought that Cain was the promised redeemer.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you imagine their pain and disappointment when the one they thought would be the redeemer turned out to be a murderer?
That is fascinating. I've never heard that. And that's the beauty of the original text. There's so much richness there. I wish somebody would write an annotated Bible and just cover everything like this. It's just so fascinating.
So I threw that one in, and I didn't want to put us behind, but I think that's an interesting point because it brings out the severity of sin and their absolute shock. They thought they were going to be returned to the garden. They thought life was going back to normal.
Yeah, they only had to wait a few thousand years, and they only lived to be 900, so what a disappointment.
But what pain sin brings. And so this is the basis, this is the foundation for understanding God's redemptive plan, that the seed of the woman would bring forth the death sentence of Satan, of the serpent. Now we jump to Genesis chapter 12. After man gets more and more evil, sin permeates the earth, and God has to destroy the earth with a flood, save Noah. And we don't hear anything about the seed promise until Genesis chapter 12, when this man Abram appears. We don't know how God revealed himself to Abram. Just says, and God had said to Abram, leave everything behind, and Genesis 12, 1 through 3. And then he states this promise. He decrees over Abram, I will bless those that bless you. I will curse the one who curses you. And then this is the big one. Through you, through your zara, through your seed, through your descendants, all the nations of the earth will be blessed.
Okay.
Every family on earth will be blessed.
Let's hang on there. We're going to come back talking to Jonathan Burness. The book is Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. This is fascinating stuff. What could God mean when he tells Abraham, through you, all the world will be blessed, all the nations of the world? We'll find out when we come back.
Sometimes it's hard to keep track of all the places we've been. Next thing you know, the night is creeping in.
Hey folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. My guest is Jonathan Burness, B-E-R-N-I-S, and the book is Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. Jonathan, you said before we went to the break that, so God singles out this random guy, Abraham. Abram is his name, actually. And says, through you and through your descendants, I'm going to bless the whole world. So out of Abraham comes the Jewish nation. And so God is setting up his plan to bring the Messiah out of the descendants of this man, out of the Jewish nation. And I've always thought it's so fascinating. You think, why would God do it this way? And I can understand a lot of people who don't believe in God or don't take the Bible seriously. They say this is so baroque and complicated. Why couldn't God just do it the easy way? Why does he do it this complicated way? And I really have no answer.
Either do I, other than he's sovereign, which means he can do what he wants, when he wants.
Yeah, but that's a cop-out answer, Jonathan. You know that's a cop-out, because it's like saying he could do it because he could do it. Nobody would doubt that he could do it, but you kind of have to wonder why. Like, why would he? And we're not going to answer it now, but it's just so funny because it does seem so complicated. But it's also really beautiful and poetic. That's what I love about
it.
Sure,
but why do bad things happen to good people? And there's a lot of things that we just don't understand.
That's exactly right.
Why didn't God just say, I pardon you all? Everyone's going to heaven. There's a lot of things that we just don't understand.
Why isn't there an infinity of parking spaces? You know, in heaven, you know that there will be an infinity of parking spaces. You will never lack for parking in heaven. It's a beautiful thing.
The next time I drive around and around looking for
a spot. Isn't it wonderful to think in heaven you're just going to be able to glide into a beautiful spot anytime you want? Okay, so let's keep going. Go ahead.
Okay, so here's this guy, Abram, and he's born into a world of idolatry. As a matter of fact, in rabbinic literature, his father owned an idol shop. Have you ever heard this one?
No.
It's actually in one of the pseudepigraphical writings. I won't get into the details of it, but the book of Jasher. And I heard this as a kid and couldn't find it in the Bible after I became a believer. But Abram worked in his father's idol shop, and according to the story, when he had this revelation of the one true God, he destroyed all the idols except one. His father came home, saw the idol shop destroyed, was really angry with Abram, and then Abram blamed it on the one idol that he left standing. And his father said, that's ridiculous, they're idols. And Abram said, well, I've made my point. It's a funny story. but I couldn't find it in the Bible anywhere.
No, it is not in the Bible, but that's, I still like it.
It's a fun story. Anyway, Abram obeys God, and this is the beginning of a people that God raises up. And we call this the Abrahamic covenant. God makes a covenant. He cuts a covenant. Blood is involved again. And he cuts this covenant with Abram, changes his name to Abraham, and decrees through you, through your descendants, through your seed, all the nations or families of the earth will be blessed. Eric, I think there's two ways to interpret this. One is corporately, that the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob corporately throughout history have been a disproportional blessing to the world. And here's, I just want to give you some statistics in my book. The Jewish people have blessed the world in countless ways. For instance, since the Nobel Prize was first awarded in 1895, 22% of all recipients have been Jewish. In fact, Jewish recipients of the Nobel Prize represent 41% of all awarded in economics to Jewish people. 28% in medicine, Jewish people, 26% in physics, 19% in chemistry. In 2013, 6 of the 8 Nobel Prizes awarded were to Jews. And I think that rate's actually gone up to 28%.
This infuriates me. Why don't they impose a diversity quota on the Nobel Prizes? You know what I'm saying? A diversity quota so they could throw a little love, you know, to the Greeks, a little love to the... It's just not right that Jews should win so many prizes. They need to have... Chuck Schumer should institute a diversity quota on the Nobel Prize. I just wanted to throw that in.
But go ahead. Here's how disproportionate it is. The Jewish population, world population, is 0.25%. That's it. That's a tiny minority. 0.25%. So, yeah, the quotas, if there was a quota, it would be, you know, one or two every decade.
I'm not trying to be funny, but I think this is why one of the reasons why so many people hate Jews, because it is clear that God has chosen the Jews, that they are special. Even if you don't believe in God, you just look at the Jews and you look at statistics like the one you just quoted and you say, this is extraordinary. It's amazing.
It's extraordinary, and it's infuriating for some. And by the way, let me just say this. There's all these theories. The Jews are so much smarter. Not true. The Jews are so much better educated. True, but what's the drive for that education? The Jews are just cleverer. They're better networkers. They're this, that, or the other thing. This is a divine election. This is a decree of God. He declared, I will make your descendants a blessing to the nations. That's the only answer. And by the way, Eric, this now we begin to have a logical explanation for anti-Semitism. I've read a lot of books on anti-Semitism, and most of them end up with the conclusion that anti-Semitism is an illogical, irrational hatred of Jewish people that has no foundation. I don't agree with that. I think that's wrong. I think that anti-Semitism is logical. I think it's systematic. I think it's calculated, because there is a Satan, a literal devil, that is seeking to destroy God's plan.
Hang on, we're going to go to a hard break. Forgive me. We'll be right back, folks. The Eric Metaxas Show. Keep asking for more ELO, and I'm just saying, here you go. Talking to Jonathan Burness. Jonathan, you were just saying this extraordinary thing, that if the Jews are chosen by God, then anti-Semitism is the devil's response. In other words, if through this people will come the Messiah who brings hope and life to the whole world beyond Israel, then Israel must be stopped. The Jews must be wiped out.
Exactly.
There is an irrational, supernatural hatred. I mean, whether you call it irrational, but the point is that there's a visceral hatred. I think it really comes from the sin nature in human beings, that out of that, the fissure of our brokenness comes this hatred of these people because they are chosen by God to bring God to everybody.
It's a satanic... It's an orchestrated effort by Satan himself, very calculated, and it's nothing more than trying to keep the death sentence of Genesis 3:15 from coming to pass. It's that logical. It's that simple to me. I really believe that. If I destroy the seed promise and the carriers of the seed promise, then Genesis 3:15 will never come to pass. And Satan really believes that. We know he's wrong, and he will be destroyed. But I think that this is a saga that history has been living out, and Israel becomes key to this at the point that God chooses Abram and later changes his name to Abraham to be the carrier of the seed promise. So I said that it's first corporate, that the Jewish people have been a disproportionate blessing to the world because of this Abrahamic decree that's still in effect today. And I believe also the statement that I will bless those who bless you and curse the one who curses you. This decree also is in effect today, and I think we see it over and over throughout history.
Well, I would agree with that. And, you know, this is, again, one of the reasons that the Bible is so fascinating is that there are puzzles and mysteries in here that you begin to see these patterns and you begin to think, this is not just some book. This is fascinating that history, you can read history and read the future in these pages, unlike, for example, Nostradamus, which is a random collection of goofy medieval French quatrains.
Well put.
Where else can we go with this? What else should we talk about?
All right, so just to finish up this idea of the Abrahamic covenant, you have this wider corporate fulfillment in the people of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, being a blessing to the world, and not always a blessing, actually. There's a verse that, as a Jewish believer, really catches my attention, that Jewish people have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge. I'm asked all the time, why are Jewish people so far to the left? And why? They're the people of the book. And the answer is that Jewish people separated from their God are looking for answers in all the wrong places. And yet we're trying to bring about tikkun olam. We're trying to bring about the restoration of the world. We're just not doing it the right way if we're separated from our Creator, from the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Karl Marx, I think, meant well. It didn't turn out
no.
so great. But anyway, the more narrow definition and the greater interpretation is the Messiah, that through the loins of Abraham would come forth this seed of the woman that would ultimately right the wrong that took place in the garden and bring everything back to the state that it was before the fall. And we've been living out that adventure, I think. And Israel now becomes key to this, not just the land, the people, but the land, because God says, go to a land that I will show you. And he gives this land, this little sliver of land, actually much larger promise then than it's realized today. The land given to Abraham was a much larger landmass than the state of Israel today. But that's for another time. So the land becomes central. The city of Jerusalem becomes central to this redemptive plan, which is what I then talk about, the restoration of the state of Israel in 1948, and specifically Jerusalem in 1967, after almost 2,000 years. This was a fulfillment of a prophecy made by Jesus himself, that Jerusalem would be trodden down by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled.
Okay, now what does that mean, until the time of the... That means that today we're living at the time of the Gentiles being fulfilled. What does that mean?
I think that it means, and I want to be a little bit careful here, because I'm influenced by both dispensational thinking and covenantal thinking, reform theology. I've been a student of both, so I don't believe in these really defined dispensations, but there's definitely redemptive moments in history, Eric, where God is going to do something great, a set time in his prophetic calendar, like the Exodus out of Egypt. So let me backtrack and talk about that for a second. The Exodus out of Egypt, the children of Israel are crying out for a redeemer, and God is raising up Moses. But in the midst of that, an Antichrist is raised up, a new Pharaoh that does not appreciate the Jewish people and sees them as a threat, the Israelites, and decrees to kill all the male children. That's a picture of the redemptive plan of God and an Antichrist that comes against that plan to try to thwart it. What happens, it's a humorous story. Moses is floated out onto the Nile and raised, found by Pharaoh's daughter and raised in the home of Pharaoh. The Redeemer, a type of Messiah, ends up being raised by in the home of this Antichrist, by this Antichrist figure. I see God's humor in it, and of course, God brings great victory through Moses, and there's a redemption. You see that before the first coming of Christ. You see another Antichrist, Herod, who calls or summons the wise men of Israel, discovers that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem according to the prophecy. And
forgive me, another hard break. Folks, we're talking to Jonathan Bernis. We'll be right back. Final segment. Stick around. Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Just a few minutes left, 4 minutes, I think, left with Jonathan Bernis. Jonathan Bernis, as we wrap this up, I just want to say it's extraordinary to me that there are so many Jews writing books about Jesus. You obviously have written this book. Jonathan Kahn has a huge book out, The Paradigm. It's fascinating to meet people who are thoroughly Jewish, who accept Jesus as Messiah. It's just happening more and more, and I find it interesting. But I just want to leap in. We've just got a few minutes left here, so how should we wrap it up if we only have?
I want to dovetail off of that statement. I think that is an indication that we're in a very unique time. You talked about the time of the Gentiles. We were talking about that. This is a shift in history. Where the gospel's going back to the Jewish people, where redemptive God's redemptive plan is returning back to Israel where it began, and I believe this is a sign that we're in the final wrap up, the last of the last days. I really believe that.
Wow. So where do you think we go from here? I mean, Israel has been created. We're living in this generation. It was created in 1948, 47. Where are we now, prophetically?
Well, the restoration of Jerusalem is key in all this, because when Jerusalem was restored in 1967, and we just celebrated the 50th year of the restoration of Jerusalem, imagine this, a land that was and a people that were destined to be destroyed by the Arab, decreed by their Arab neighbors, will push you into the sea, and Israel's not only survived but prospered, and now we're coming up on the 70th anniversary of the State of Israel. This is really miraculous, Eric.
But a lot of people think, based on that, that God would have wrapped history up by now. Like the idea that it's 70 years since Israel was founded, it does seem odd in a way, because, you know, you hear people say that a generation is 40 years. And so in 1988, people were thinking about it. So it is interesting. I mean,
That's true. There's no doubt. We can't set dates. It was 40, then 50, now 70. I don't know. The specifics of what's ahead. I do know this, that Jewish people are getting saved in greater numbers than any time since the first century. We're seeing whole tribes of Jewish people, scattered tribes, the lost tribes, in places like Ethiopia and Zimbabwe, being discovered and coming to faith in their Messiah, and Jewish people from the corners of the earth returning to the land of Israel. I think that's all significant.
You're telling my listeners, buy beef jerky and water purifying tablets, and head for the bunkers. I know, I'm kidding. Of course, I'm kidding. But it is interesting. It is very interesting. All of this stuff is interesting, Jonathan. I really think that it's important that we understand the role of Israel and how there is a prophetic clock, and we can't say if it's going to happen Tuesday or Wednesday or this year or that year, but it is clear. You can kind of see, you know, when the leaves are on the trees, you know, oh, it's spring. I don't know the exact date, but things are happening.
There's signs of the times. That's the kind of the bottom line. There's signs of the times, and we're to be paying attention to the signs of the times.
Exactly. Well, it's been a delight having you, as I knew it would be. Jonathan Bernis, thank you for being my guest.
Thank you for having me back.
Folks, the book is Unlocking the Prophetic Mysteries of Israel. It is just out now. Grab a copy, and thanks for listening. And please tell your friends about the show.